Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're going to jump into the show with very little fanfare today. These are certainly not normal times for any of us, and nor are they times that we can sit back and silently accept what's happening under the rule of the fascist regime. Look at what is going on in the world today. If this is not stopped, all of humanity will pay a terrible price, all the way up to the death of the planet. And never forget that this system is responsible for the horrors we face now, and it is up to us to stand up and stop these horrors that we face across the globe today. On today's show, we will feature a number of people speaking to the hard reality of what's happening in the world and the United States today. At the back end of the show, we will hear an interview with Dr. Phil Rice, digging into the reality of the pandemic threatening all of humanity. Dr. Rice was featured on the RNL show, which stands for Revolution Nothing Less, and is featured on the YouTube channel, The RevComs. It's a new weekly show, and we will be talking with people from the RNL show next week, so stay tuned for that. Now, I am pleased to welcome to the show journalist Sasha Abramski. Sasha's work has appeared in numerous outlets across the country, and he also writes a weekly political column. Sasha, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing, you know, it's hard to say I'm doing good, but in all things added,
you're doing okay.
Yeah, I'm doing okay, but we got a hell of a lot of stuff that we got to go up against, and it took a minute for, I think, the magnitude of this, basically of the coronavirus to register, and in some ways it seems that it really still has not registered that much, that it's not understood in terms of this event and the danger it's bringing to the world. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, this thing emerged in China at the very end of last year, and the default psychological reaction around the world was, oh, this is a problem for somewhere else. And I think that, you know, that's part of the human condition, that when really bad, sometimes overwhelming news comes our way, our psychological sort of protective mechanism is to say, oh, this could only happen to someone else. It can't happen here. There's a reason it's happening over there. And so we tend to sort of minimize the risks to ourselves and to our way of life and to the things that we take for granted because the alternative is so overwhelming. And I think we saw that especially in America. But to be fair, much of the rest of the world sort of experienced the same thing. So in Western Europe, for example, life just went on as normal. You had these great cities with these great cultural events, and you had public transport going, and you had people staying out till 2 or 3 in the morning at bars and cafes and clubs. And people didn't want to see the danger that crowded environments would pose. And so I think what happened was we were in denial and we were in denial and we were in denial until suddenly it was such an enormous cascading problem that all in a rush, the world began shutting down. And so I think we're sort of seeing the boomerang effect of 2 months of both individual denial on the sort of population's behalf, but also denial at the highest levels of government, where organizations and institutions that could and should have been preparing really stood back and did nothing. So you had the federal government here in the United States that, you know, was getting all kinds of warnings from its public disease specialists and from its intelligence agencies saying, you better get ready for this. And yet, there was no move to activate the Defense Production Act. There was no move to increase the number of ventilators being made. There was no move even to do basic things like get more face masks and gloves available for doctors and nurses. And this, to me, is extraordinary. You know, it's one thing when an individual makes a bad psychological decision around this. It's quite another thing when government agencies and heads of state make that same decision.
And particularly when you're talking about this, you know, some of the things that have happened already in relation to this before this broke out as big as it is in the world right now, you know, you make a point that you can't be really contained and that there's an example of countries that have tried to and tens of millions have tried to survive, but there's a mind-boggling number of people who died in the process of trying. This is something I don't think people get in terms of the seriousness of this. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit.
Well, look, I mean, I'm not a public health specialist. I analyze the way all of this impacts politics and economics and so on. But my reading of this is, you know, this is a very serious disease. It's very contagious. It's a respiratory ailment. And it infects people who can then pass along the disease while being asymptomatic. And when you put all of those things together, and the fact there's no human immunity to this because it's a new disease, when you put all of this together, it doesn't really take a rocket scientist to realize the scale of the problem that we're facing, not just as a country, but as a global civilization. And so we're going to get through this. We're a very adaptive, we're a very innovative, we're a very resilient species. We are going to get through this. But we're going to have tremendous social and economic disruption and tremendous pain in the process. And one of the things that interests me as I'm writing about this and thinking about this is, how do we adapt politically, and how do we adapt culturally, and how do we adapt economically to something that clearly isn't a 2-week or 3-week problem, but is going to be a huge problem facing humanity for at least a couple years, until there's a widely available vaccine, assuming there's a widely available vaccine. Now, what that means is that the way we do business, and I mean that in the broader sense, the way we do politics, the way we interact as human beings, the way we build community, all of that's up in the air at the moment. And you see the beginnings of a sort of struggle over how this plays out. So on the one hand, you have tremendously progressive political ideas rising to the fore, people talking about basic universal income or universal basic income, people talking about ways to manage the pain so that people aren't evicted when they can't pay their rent and that kind of thing. On the other hand, you have the rise of this extraordinary sort of dictatorial nationalism in some countries. You saw it in Hungary this week, where Viktor Orban announced he would be ruling by decree. You've seen it here in the United States, where the pandemic has been used as a cover to clamp down even harder on asylum and refugee cases and to lock down even further border. We're seeing it with the throwing back across the border of asylum seekers with absolutely no due process. And it's getting no attention because we're all preoccupied by the actual coronavirus itself and the public health implications. But make no mistake, this pandemic is throwing everything up in the air, and progressives have an opportunity for tremendous political change, but reactionaries have the same opportunity. And all kinds of new politics are going to be playing out over the coming years as a result of what's happening in the public health arena.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump into that, because that's something that really struck me in your writing around this. You talk about, in the midst of all this, you have the coronavirus pandemic sending us back to the days of racist quarantines, wholesale travel bans of Chinese nationals. There's something that's going on, you know, where you're looking at this, and you started to hit at this. There's something that's going on in a big way in terms of what is jumping out now. And I'd like to explore more what you brought up earlier about just what is happening in the world in terms of the various imperial powers, the people that, it really does remind me of something like, okay, there's blocks forming, there's ruling classes fighting over who's going to get what where. And meanwhile, the people are suffering hugely.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, when you look at the histories of pandemics and epidemics globally over many, many hundreds or even thousands of years, that when people are really, really scared and when they're facing an unknown, it oftentimes, at least in the short term, brings out the worst in us. So we start blocking strangers, we start putting up barriers, physical and psychological, against other people. And at the most basic level, we look for scapegoats. So if a virus is circulating, we say it was brought here by those outsiders, and we turn on those outsiders. And this isn't unique to America in 2020. This is happening all over the world. So you see racist attacks against Asians in big cities across the world. You see vigilantism emerging. Yesterday, the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, issued this extraordinary order on national television saying that anyone who broke quarantine laws could now be shot dead by the police in the streets. I mean, these are just extraordinary things that are emerging as we sort of become more and more scared by this cascading pandemic. So, you know, there is a real risk that we are going to see vigilante violence. There's a real risk that, you know, if there are food shortages in parts of the world, you might see tremendous outbreaks of food riots, and then the state responding with force. You could envision a scenario where supply chains break down and governments force people back to work by force. So, you know, in the short term, the stresses on public order, but also the stresses on constitutional government, become immense, because you have this public health crisis that has morphed into an economic crisis. The economic crisis is then going to obviously hit people at the bottom of wealthy economies and people all across the less developed world like a sledgehammer. It's going to take away their jobs, it's going to take away income, and in most countries, most people live pretty much hand-to-mouth. They live by what they can earn in any given week. So in America or Britain or Germany, there's some resources available to backstop the pain. So America's increasing the amount of unemployment insurance it pays out. It's putting out all kinds of loans to small businesses. It's subsidizing large businesses so they can get back on their feet. But a lot of countries that have less resources, their economies are going to be absolutely flattened by this, and it's going to take years, maybe decades, to recover. And that's going to create a whole bunch of economic pain, and at the most primal level, it's going to result in a huge amount of disruption where people struggle just to put food on the table, just to keep a shelter over their heads. And that's going to play out again in all kinds of unpredictable ways politically. You don't have to look very far back. You only have to look to what happened in the wreckage of the post-World War I period and then the wreckage of the post-1929 economic collapse. You see what happens when major economies suddenly go into freefall. You see what happens when a critical mass of desperate people are on the streets, and it plays out in very ugly ways politically. And so that's going to be our challenge. The health challenge is obviously the first thing. But once we gain control of that, once the epidemic is curbed, once treatments start coming online, once eventually a vaccine starts coming online, the longer-term challenge is going to be, how do we deal with the political fallout that this creates?
Yeah, and I want to pursue that a little bit, because you've referred to that a lot in your writing. And I want, you know, part of this thing about the mass quantities of U.S. citizens coming back from parts of China, and they've been, you know, what's actually been happening to them as they get here, students at colleges in Pennsylvania, this kind of was like, came out of nowhere to me. It's like, so, you know, I'm going along reading what you're writing and all this stuff, and the whole thing about the quarantines appearing all over the world. And then for a lot of people here, I don't think they get that it's happening here as well. And you pointed out to students at a college in Pennsylvania getting mandatory 14-day quarantine at their college because they went to China on their break.
I mean, to be fair, that was written about a month ago. In the mm-hmm. intervening period, pretty much every country on Earth is now implementing quarantines. And most countries on Earth have either stopped or severely curbed all international travel. And so you do have this sort of localizing of risk, if you like, where each country is trying to sort of self-contain their own epidemics and deal with their own epidemics. The scale of what's unfolding now in the United States, where you have nearly 250,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19, you have a cascading number of deaths, means it's all but inevitable that between now and the summer, we're going to have stay-at-home orders covering not all, but most of the country. And you're going to see these spikes in deaths in certain regions. We're seeing it already in New York. We saw it in Seattle. We're seeing it now in New Orleans, in Detroit, and various other places. And as those local epidemics peak, you are going to have curbs on travel. You're going to have either voluntary or mandatory quarantines of people coming in and out of those areas. Every country on Earth seems to be adopting that. Italy's had full lockdown now for a month. Spain's had full lockdown for a month. England's gone into near full lockdown mode. So you're seeing this sort of increasingly draconian response because the alternative is complete overwhelming of public hospitals. But I do want to come back to this sort of notion of how do you preserve social order and how do you preserve functioning healthcare systems, because it seems to me that in both of those regards, America's uniquely vulnerable. It's a highly unequal society. It's got a very patchwork social safety net. It's got an awful lot of people with no access to paid sick leave, and it ties healthcare coverage to a large extent to one's job. So in addition to all the other problems that every other country faces, America's got this additional problem that as millions upon millions of jobs are lost, and it's 10 million jobs in the last 2 weeks. I mean, that's just an unfathomable number. Many of those people will have lost their health insurance as they lost their jobs. So just at the moment when you need maximum healthcare coverage, because you need everybody being tested, you need to isolate people who have got the disease so they don't spread infection, just at that moment when you need coverage to be as extensive as possible, America's going into reverse, and millions of Americans suddenly find they have no health insurance, and to maintain coverage, they suddenly have to go onto the healthcare exchanges, they have to buy on the private market, they have to pay out of pocket for COBRA. What that means is that we're going to have a dramatically increased healthcare coverage crisis in addition to a crisis of the actual disease itself.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, because you referred to earlier to the economic crisis in 1929 and how that, you know, it, basically there's a question here, because this led directly to Hitler in 1933. And when you look at like what's happening now in relation to this society, there's some very dangerous things, you know, cropping up and beginning to take shape in relation to all this.
Well, this is why I was saying everything's up in the air, and that you have this moment where really progressive ideas could take root, the idea that we should have universal health care being a case in point. But at the same time, you clearly have trends in society which have been there for many, many years that Donald Trump exploited very effectively in 2016. You have these very right-wing, very authoritarian, very fear-based trends as well. And those trends could easily become dominant over the next few years. You could see a dramatically ramped up xenophobia. You could see dramatically increased border controls. You could see a militarization of civil society. You could see a dramatic expansion of the surveillance state, using the notion that we have to track any and every potential COVID-19 case as an excuse to basically create a very Orwellian system where every aspect of our life is being monitored. Now, none of that's inevitable, but there's certainly trends in America, in Trump's America in particular, that make it very, very worrying, and that at least pose the risk that if our economy goes into not just a 2 or 3 month sort of deep freeze, but into a long-term economic collapse, if this resembles the Great Depression more than a sort of V-shaped depression followed by a quick recovery, if we end up in a Great Depression Mark II, given who's in charge of the country right now, you have to assume that some really ugly politics are going to be unleashed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, one thing that I think is actually kind of, I think, really important in relation to what you're saying, you know, you've written about how around the world, this whole pandemic is spreading and the terror associated with the unknown diseases that has become a petri dish for the rise of intolerance and a broader epidemic of violence. And I think that's something that we really got to look at, because that's part of what you're talking about when you're talking about what happened in Nazi Germany and what's been happening, you know, throughout the years before that and since that. But it gets concentrated in moments like this. And I think this is something that's really important for people to understand, because there is a massive amount of, you know, things that when you wrote about that I wasn't aware of, the amount of discrimination and oppression of people simply because of who they are, where they're from, you know, what their status is in society. This is a huge and very dangerous thing to be developing.
It is, and you know, it's obviously in the moment it's about COVID-19, but it goes way beyond COVID-19. It's about how we understand risk. It's about how we distribute blame when things go wrong. It's about who our resources are channeled towards and who's viewed as enough part of the society that they get those resources and who's viewed as being so expendable that they don't get those resources. And, you know, again, this is part of a huge international conversation. The case in point would be there are tens of millions of displaced people at the moment around the world, about 70 million displaced people. It's the highest number it's been since World War II. And yet, as this epidemic intensifies, those individuals are increasingly locked out of access to safety. They're essentially bottled up in these refugee camps. All refugee movement, all asylum movement around the world is basically at a standstill. And those individuals in refugee camps, refugees from, for example, the war in Syria, are uniquely vulnerable to medical disaster because they're already malnourished, they're already suffering from trauma, they live in extraordinarily overcrowded camps, there's very little sanitation in those camps, inadequate supplies of medicine, inadequate supplies of food, and so on. And so you do have this situation where risk compounds risk, and the most vulnerable people on earth at a moment like this become even more vulnerable. And I think, you know, we see the same in the United States. There are tens of thousands of asylum seekers and other immigrants who are in ICE detention facilities, and thousands of doctors, 3,000 doctors, recently sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security saying you need to release these people because they're in such crowded, dangerous conditions that they are going to fall prey to coronavirus and suffer horrendous casualties. And so far, ICE has released nobody for that reason. But you're also seeing it in jails and prisons. There's been an outbreak of coronavirus in Cook County. There's been an outbreak in Rikers Island. There are outbreaks in prisons in California. All over the country, there is a risk that because we have so many people behind bars, we have over 2 million people in jails and prisons. It's the largest incarcerated population on earth. And again, that population is peculiarly vulnerable to an epidemic that spreads in closed, confined spaces. Another example, we have 500,000 people homeless on the streets in America. Here in California, we got about 130,000. Now, Gavin Newsom is moving at least some of those men and women into shelters, into motels, into trailers during this crisis. But when I walk around Sacramento, there's still an awful lot of homeless people on the streets. I assume the same holds in San Francisco, in LA, and so on. And again, these individuals already have pre-existing conditions. They're already suffering all of the health consequences of sleeping rough on the streets, which means they are, again, peculiarly vulnerable to coronavirus. So I think all of the inequalities that we see are going to be magnified by an epidemic like this. And again, it sort of creates a political question. How do we respond to those inequalities at the back end? What lessons do we learn from this? Mm-hmm. Do we learn progressive lessons, or do we just batten down the hatches, become ever less empathic, ever more coercive?
Throughout your articles, you've actually pointed to this a number of times, and that is the point about, you know, how a lot of this stuff is, it happens, it's also rooted in a lot of things like what's happening at the borders, border militarization, all the things you've been talking about, but it's also this social panic that you referred to, you know, the heavy violence and racism and intolerance that's been unleashed. And when you look at this, when you look at what's happening with the, you know, all that's going on, the rise of nationalism and the militarization of the borders, these, you know, all kinds of things are crumbling. The very structure of society that's existed, well, you know, it's been, you know, tumbling down a little bit here and there, and it's been getting sharper and sharper. But there seems to be, in the midst of all this, there's a whole new approach that's being taken up by all these various fascist forces, and they're being encouraged by what's being done in these various countries, including the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've taken an awful lot of things for granted over the last 50 or 60 years because they made our lives good and they made our lives convenient. We could travel all over the world easily and relatively affordably if we were lucky enough to live in a first world country like the United States, which sort of basically gave us a passport of access to the rest of the world. We assumed and took for granted that we would have global trade, that we could have things made anywhere and then distributed anywhere, and that the result of that would be the sort of cornucopia where we could have whatever we wanted, whenever we wanted, at very low prices. And all of that's breaking down at the moment. The travel, you've seen a complete collapse in international travel. You've seen the erection of border barriers that haven't been present in the case of Europe for a generation. You're seeing the literal shutting down of borders, the collapse of international flight patterns. And then you're seeing global shortages because individual countries are locking down their own food supplies or locking down their own medical supplies. And so one of the secondary consequences is these global supply systems that are so integral to the way the economy functions have sort of started to stutter and sputter and in some cases actually break down entirely. And, you know, again, this could be a short-term dislocation, but it's entirely possible that at the back end of all this, the way we do trade and the way we interact with the rest of the world and even the way we travel to other places within the world, all of that's going to look different. And, you know, it's very possible that ease of access, that the convenience where we just jump on a plane, spend a few hundred dollars on a ticket, jump on a plane, a few hours later we're halfway around the world, it's entirely possible that may look like a glorious memory from the past and that whatever the new normal looks like is going to be more convoluted, that we're going to have to maybe get more visas to travel places. Maybe we're going to have to produce medical documentation. Maybe we're going to have to go through fever checks at airports. Maybe we're going to have to go through short quarantines at the other end, all of which is sort of unfathomable to the modern imagination. It completely changes the way we live and engage with the rest of the world. But it's entirely possible it will be a sort of collateral consequence of what we're living through at the moment.
You know, one of the things, too, that we always really, I think we really have to keep in mind is that in the midst of all this, we have a lot of the populations in these countries and in the U.S. in particular that I'm familiar with in terms of the people who have been driven here by the terrible conditions in their own countries. They've crossed the border. They've been living here. They've been doing, you know, basically trying to eke out an existence for themselves and their families at home. And, you know, there's this whole thing that is being, you know, what's being concentrated in terms of what in terms of the people that rule in the U.S. right now and other places, but the whole assessment of, you know, look, this is actually something that could give rise to, and in some ways is already beginning to give rise to the beginning portion, the way this folds out in a beginning sense, is the idea that there basically has to be this. I mean, I'll just say it. It makes me think a lot of, again, what happened in Nazi Germany. Again, what's happened in various, you know, countries around the world where moves have been made by the ruling classes that this is what's necessary. And you're talking about this now in terms of the U.S., and they really are faced with a situation where, look, they're militarizing daily life, as you pointed to. They lead to, you know, there's something. A lot of things that they're doing are very dangerous and deadly, and not that many people are standing up and speaking out against it right now. It's a fairly, you know, I don't know what to say. It's a very frightening, but it's also one that should make people sit up and look at it and
well,
figure out.
I think what's happening is people are so sort of shell-shocked by the rapidity of the change in their lives. I mean, if you think about it, 3 weeks ago, most of us in America were going about our normal lives. We were going to work. We were going out to restaurants. We were going to cafes and bars, maybe going to see a movie. And all of that has just gone by the wayside. So I think part of it is shell shock, that the rapidity with which our normal lives have disintegrated is so unprecedented that we're just sitting here, we're stuck in our homes, we're obsessively watching the news or scrolling on our cell phones to see the latest headlines, and the news is all bad. It's bad in terms of the health data, it's bad in terms of the economy, and it's terrifying to us. Now, you know, one of the things we do when we're scared is we monofocus. And I've written a lot about this. When you get very, very scared about something, your peripheral vision, your peripheral focus basically goes away, and all your attention is put on the immediate danger. And, you know, that's a survival strategy. But the danger of that is that the rest of the world doesn't stop. So an example would be, under cover of this pandemic, the administration yesterday rolled out a huge, huge reversal of Obama-era fuel efficiency standards. And what it's going to mean if it passes, unless it gets blocked by the courts, what it's going to mean is that this country basically goes on a pollution rampage, that we make our cars and our trucks and our SUVs less fuel efficient than they would have been. We pump billions more tons of CO2 into the air. We burn billions more gallons of gas each year, entirely unnecessarily. It's a complete boon to an oil industry lobby, basically. Now, that was done under cover of the pandemic because nobody's paying attention. There have been these changes to immigration enforcement laws during the pandemic, and again, nobody's paying attention. Texas and Ohio last week tried, they didn't get away with it, but they tried to ban all abortions in the state as being elective surgeries and therefore not necessary during a pandemic. So you're seeing all kinds of weird power grabs that are taking place while our attention is focused on the public health emergency and the economic emergency that accompanies it. So, you know, I think it's not surprising. I think that the way we're responding at the moment is very short term. I think over the months ahead, gradually our focus will return, and gradually our outrage at what is happening around immigration and all these other issues around environmental pollution, our outrage will return as well. But at the moment, we're kind of frozen in place, we're kind of shell-shocked, and there's a real danger that a lot of bad things will go on while we're in that shell-shocked condition.
And you know what? You know, here's the thing too, though, because just speaking to what you've just been talking about, yeah, but we're still left with the question of what has been done. We're left with the question of what has been done already, what direction it's going in. And basically, people here, you know, I don't know. You know, I don't know how many people have actually recognized that this, you know, the installation of a fascist regime, how much have they recognized what's going on in the society and where it's headed? You know, and the whole thing of so much has been allowed. I mean, so much has been allowed to in the rounding up of immigrants. And you think about the things that have happened just even before this began and how much more intense it's going to be in the current period. You know, you're left with that question of what's been taken away from people, but more the struggle against what's been done by the system right now. And people, you know, there needs to be something really standing up against this and recognizing what's going on. But if that doesn't happen, I fear that we're in an extremely dangerous situation. It's not like just sort of all these, you know, sort of, well, there's these certain ways that they've twisted things. There's an actual program that's being hammered down and put into place. And it is a very, very, I mean, I can only say it's, from what I understand of fascism, and I have read a lot about it, it is headed, if not already, I think it's in that. And now the question is, what are we going to do in relation to that? How are we going to recognize it, and what do we do in relation to that?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with a lot of what you're saying. I think there was a tremendous awareness of this, not amongst everybody, but a lot of organizers on the ground and a lot of people who previously were apolitical were coming out into the streets in 2017, 18, 19, because there was an awareness of the danger of the moment. And so you did see tremendous activism to protect immigrants' rights. You saw tremendous numbers of people coming out to protest on the environment front. You saw a lot of workers organizing to protect wages in the face of a federal government that seemed intent on undermining wage protections, weakening even further trade unions, and so on. All of that activism at the moment has sort of retreated online because we're all staying indoors. So you're absolutely right that there is this danger that in a moment when it's almost impossible to mobilize and organize on the streets, that gives cover to sort of programmatic authoritarians. And clearly, the Trump administration is stocked filled with authoritarians. You know, this idea that they were just a bunch of eccentric, not terribly effective, incompetent, somewhat clownish people who bumbled into power just doesn't make sense. They may have sort of stumbled into power despite themselves, but once they were in power from the get-go, they've known how to use that power very ruthlessly. And there's no evidence that their ruthlessness is being diluted by this crisis. Quite the reverse. All the evidence suggests that as the crisis intensifies, their responses will become more authoritarian, not less. And so I do think, you know, again, we got to look at the short term, and the short term is about public health. And we got to look at the long term, and the long term is as much about political response as it is about the public health response. And in the long term, we're going to have to work out ways to organize and to mobilize like we never have before.
All right, Sasha Abramsky, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and stay well and stay healthy.
You too, bro. All right.
All right, take care.
Bye. This is The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking today with Sasha Abramsky. Sasha is a freelance journalist and a part-time lecturer at the University of California, Davis, and his work has appeared in numerous publications, including The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, New York Magazine, The Village Voice, and Rolling Stone. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Now we'll hear an important interview with Andy Z, one of the co-hosts of the RNL show, conducted with Dr. Phil Rice about what we're facing right now.
So I'm very pleased to have as a first guest on the RNL show, Revolution Nothing Less, Dr. Phil Rice, who's the emergency medicine director at North Shore Hospital in Salem, Massachusetts. Phil is an international expert in emergency room care. Welcome, Phil.
Thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so we'll get back to that T-shirt you're wearing now. As I said, it's not the mandatory garb in the emergency room, but it's an important shirt because we do face a double-edged emergency, one, with the coronavirus, and two, with this Trump-Pence regime and how this they're mishandling this, to put it as mildly as I possibly can, and we'll get a little more sharp as we go along the conversation. But first, it's really important that people understand what is this coronavirus and why should they be concerned and why are we concerned?
Okay, so the coronavirus is a type of virus that infects cells with a positive stranded RNA, which is different than our genetic makeup, which is made up mainly of DNA and RNA. It doesn't use its own machinery. It has none. So it has to use your cell's machinery that makes protein to make to replicate itself or make copies of itself. And the thing about this virus is that we don't have any immunity to it because it jumped from other mammals and birds to humans. And this has been occurring more frequently. There have been 20 documented jumps from animals and mammals or birds to humans over the last 15 years, and seven of them within the last decade. And we think it's because mankind is encroaching upon the habitat of these animals, and we weren't in such close proximity to them. That's a theory. It's not proven. And this virus is a virus that is highly infectious. and probably more infectious than we even know, since we don't have the testing capabilities to actually ascertain its infectiousness presently. And it preferentially looks at more older people rather than younger people in terms of its case fatality rate. The reason we should be worried about it is, one, is that it can cause severe disease. Two, it can be spread. Three, it spreads before the patient is or a person is symptomatic. And so the last thing that we are scared of is that even after the patients become asymptomatic, there's shedding of the virus long after, sometimes weeks after they have become feeling completely normal. And we don't know what that shedding, how infective it is. We see it in both the aerosol as well as the feces. And but we know that the genome is there because we've tested it. So this virus will quickly spread amongst very closely and dense populations. And we saw in Wuhan province how it just exploded in a matter of days to in a city the size of 17 million people. And we're seeing the same thing happen in our populations in this country. It's not going to stop because somebody thinks it's a hoax. It's not going to stop until we take the measures necessary to prevent its spread, and ultimately what's needed is a vaccine.
Just jump ahead, and you know, we can circle back to some of these points. What is the situation you know, in the emergency rooms at present, and what are we actually concerned about in terms of the overrunning of the U.S. medical system, the emergency system, the preparations that are done, the care of healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, other people who are necessary to provide this care, as well as the equipment, and the fact that in many ways the horse is out of the barn, or maybe it's the bat that's out of the barn, I don't know. But in any case, the point is that there's this virus is spreading, and as you were saying, the fatality rate is fairly high. Even the lowest percentage, I understand, would be like 0.08 or 0.8, and the highest might be even 3 or 4% of infected people. So that's numbers, but we should put some, give people a sense of what are the number of lives behind it. Why are we having this, what they're calling it, stay in place, you know, it's quarantine of whole states now and cities?
Well, I think that the situation in the emergency department is that you've got frontline people that are trying to get their arms around a virus that we don't know much about. And it can present in a myriad of ways. And this is what happened in Wuhan, China, where 20% of their entire medical workforce was infected and waylaid before they even could respond in a meaningful way. They had to get people from outside, particularly the military and volunteers from other provinces, to come in and staff these places. And we're already seeing a number of people that are infected in the emergency departments. And in order to protect yourself, you need to shield yourself, wear eye goggles, hair wear. You need masks, special kinds of masks, especially if you're doing aerosol-generating procedures. And you need gowns and gloves. And the masks are the primary mechanism by which you're going to prevent the virus getting into you. Goggles are, it can also get in through your eyes, your conjunctiva. So you have to wear eyewear protection with this. And a lot of people in the medical community are struggling to get many of these supplies. Most are being told they only have 1 or 2 day supplies. And we just came out with Nebraska's now using UV light to reuse the same masks over and over again, which is, you know, what we have been taught is that's not the right thing to do, is go into one infected patient and with the same mask and stuff and walk into another patient's room with that infected gear and potentially pass on that same infection. And it may not be, in since you don't know what's who has what immediately, because it takes time for tests to come back, you could have patients with influenza A being spread to COVID A, and you could have COVID-19 infected patients being spread to influenza B or respiratory syncytial viruses.
There's a social reason why we don't have the masks we need. In fact, the misinformation that masks themselves wouldn't do any good. Then there's a question of testing. Now, in California, I was reading the LA County regulations that are going out to all the medical centers, emergency rooms, and all this that are saying, we're not going to test in most cases. If you you present at a medical facility, we'll decide if your symptoms are such that you need urgent care. Fair way to put it to people so they understand this?
Yes. First of all, let's be 100% clear. It is not influenza. It is not influenza. It is a completely different class of viruses, much like Ebola or Marburg or some of these other viruses that infect us, like hepatitis C or B. It is, or smallpox, it is not the influenza. And we have a shared immunity to influenza over the years of getting infected with it. And we have been looking for a pandemic with influenza because for the last 100 years, influenza has only made real minor jumps in changes in the way it mutates. At some point, it's going to make a major jump, and we're going to see 1918 all over again. Well, we didn't have to wait for the flu because coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2A or COVID-19, that's already appeared, and it's already a pandemic. It's already killing people across the globe. We don't have any immunity to it presently, and we don't know what it's going to ultimately end up doing. The mortality rates differ amongst the age groups, and it differs in what part of the globe you're also in. In China, it affected age groups much more so in the senior section, 50 and above, but we're finding that at least 20% of those hospitalized in Europe and in Italy were in the 20 to 65 age group. And so it's different there than it was in China. We don't know why. And we don't know what it's going to produce here. It could attack at the same way, at the same rates in different age groups in Europe as it does here, or in China as it does here, but we don't know yet. We're starting to see the great waves of things hit in New York and Washington and parts of California. But we haven't got a lot of data on what they have seen and how it's been affecting which age groups just yet. But the papers are coming in daily, so it changes hour by hour almost.
Okay, well, I wanted to, talk a little bit about the ways in which this society is set up, and then, of course, the Trump-Pence regime who's been ruling, the lack of preparedness, and how we've just gone through for our audience some of what the medical aspects of this disease are and why it's so important that we prevent the transmission of this to people. Because one of the things is that we should bring out that you don't know if you have it often until it's you're infectious, and there is no testing now. But I would like to talk about, there's a social reason why we don't have the masks we need. In fact, the misinformation that masks themselves wouldn't do any good. Then there's a question of testing. Now, in California, I was reading the LA County regulations that are going out to all the medical centers, emergency rooms, and all this that are saying, we're not going to test in most cases. If you you present at a medical facility, we'll decide if your symptoms are such that you need urgent care with ventilators or oxygen and need to be brought into the hospital. We don't have to test you for that. The only time, or the main time, we'll test you is if there's some question as to how serious your disease is going to develop. And there are some other provisions for emergency workers that they claim can get tested, although there's reports coming in the local media here that emergency workers can't get tested because there are no tests. So this is a situation where the social problem of a system for profit and a system run by anti-science cabal of Trump and Pence and their whole administration
who've gotten rid of all the departments of that would monitor all this infectious diseases and be prepared for it, has made the situation worse, not just in terms of the immediate suffering, but actually could cause the acceleration of the disease here. So I'd like you to, you know, how is this actually playing out in the, you know, in the larger population and in the and in those providing care?
Well, I think that I'd like to speak to this point about not testing. That's in fact the wrong thing to do. You need to test, and do more tests so that you know what your denominator is as to how many people are infected, so that you can figure out how to sequester or to mitigate the spread of it. The social distancing will do so much, but you've got to do so much more. For the longest period of time, hospitals were cut to the bone because Wall Street basically wanted them to have just-in-time production, which is, you know, somebody gets sick, then bring on a doctor, you know, and a nurse to take care of them. Don't have them waiting and ready, because that's a waste of money that we could be putting in the pockets of shareholders. So you have a supply system that is just based on just what's needed and looking at what your average PAR levels are for all sorts of things. But then when something like this comes along, you don't have a stockpile of things ready for a disaster. You have no disaster preparedness. And then you don't have the tests that were developed already in the international scene. The United States didn't want to use the German tests that the WHO adopted. They wanted to develop their own. And then when they developed their own, it was faulty. They didn't have the reagents were bad. And so already we're half a month behind, and this virus is not going to give us that time and that luxury to utilize and throw away that kind of time. So I think that it's going to spell disaster for, and a lot of people, bottom line is a lot of people are probably going to die unnecessarily, as much as it pains me to say that. And it's because of the way the system is built up. And then 55% to 60% of all the masks made in the world are coming from China. And then Trump puts $230 billion worth of tariffs on this country and then backtracks and makes an exception for medical supplies. It's a recipe for disaster.
There's some false information out there that, well, masks are only necessary if you have the disease. Therefore, most people shouldn't be wearing masks. And it should actually be in demand right now that these things be produced, which, of course, Trump brays and brags and the self-involved narcissist that he is, but more than that, the fascist that he is refused to issue an order to actually expedite the production of masks, because they could actually, even at this late date, save lives.
The way to stop this virus is that everybody who's in public wears a mask continuously while they're in public. And I don't go anywhere without my mask. And for two reasons. One, I'm COVID-19 positive, and so I have the disease. It doesn't feel good. And I don't want this on my family. I don't want this for my neighbors, and I don't want this for my colleagues that are around me. But for the longest time, up until this week, they gave the order that only when you're seeing patients do you wear the mask. The problem is when you have an asymptomatic patient, you have no idea, or your colleagues that you're working with, the nurses beside you, the doctors, the techs, the transporters, you don't know who has this virus, and they are shedding it continuously. And so the thing is that if you have a mask on, that allows you to at least some modicum of protection, and also prevents you, if since you don't know if you have it and could be spreading it and potentially killing your older, you know, siblings or parents or grandparents, etc. Nobody wants to have that resting on their shoulders that they gave the virus to somebody and they killed somebody. So the thing is that you should be masked all the time. But the reason they didn't was it was their way of rationing what supplies that they had, because they fumbled the whole thing to begin with when we told them that they should have been preparing for this. And then in the New York Times, it comes out, you know, they had actually scenarioed this a year ago and still didn't prepare for anything. So The answer is that everybody should be masked. Everybody should be practice social distancing. And if we look at what happened in the last 5 days, China has had zero transmissions, and that's because they are all wearing masks all the time.
But could you just say what you mean by shedding the virus?
In other words, you have the virus in you, and how does it get from in you to outside where it could infect somebody else? Well, we don't know all of the ways, but we know that the virus is in all of the secretions in our bodies. It is that's because of the where it attaches to when it wants to invade a cell. It attaches to a protein called ACE2. And our ACE2s are in numerous places in our body, including our gastrointestinal tract. And we shed the virus in our feces. It's in the urine. It's in our eye. It can go through our mucosa. There's and our saliva. In addition, our breathing. And we do know that it's aerosolized. It's not just droplet, which is what we were told initially, and people let their guard down and didn't realize that it was aerosolized until people started getting infected.
What does aerosolized mean?
It means that it's kind of like on a cold day when you see your breath. You can see your breath, and it spreads. And whereas droplets are almost like spit, it immediately drops to the ground within a 3-foot radius. And therefore, as long as you're more distant than that, you're most likely not going to get infected. Well, it turns out that it is aerosolized to some degree. And we don't know exactly how much, but we think it stays in the air for at least 30 minutes, and it can travel up to 18 feet. So that's off of a Chinese bus study that they did that was published, where guy in the back, because they videotaped all their buses, who's getting on, who gets off, et cetera. Guy in the back's coughing, and everybody up to 8 rows in front of him got infected. They get off the bus. The bus is idle. 30 minutes later, more people get on, and then all of a sudden, those people get infected. So it clearly is in the air. Now, some say, well, that study was a little bit faulty because the bus had air conditioning that may have been circulating that air abnormally, but the fact is it's aerosolized, and you have to wear a mask to prevent that.
The situation now where we have to, on the one hand, take these health measures, and that's sort of the key thing that we're asking people to do, and that is correct to be asking people to do, but at the same time, there are outrageous things that this government has done and things that they are not doing to mitigate this disease, that has to be a demand from the people. Yes, a good deal on the internet, but not only on the internet. We'll be talking about this later in another interview we're doing in the show. But in New Jersey, they had a car caravan that surrounded the ICE center, demanding that these detainees be released or be put into some kind of situation where they're not essentially sitting in a locked box. Particularly when you say this is aerosol transmitted. That means everybody in these centers, and I won't, but I could go on for some time. I'm just like, this has got my blood boiling here about all of what's actually happening. We should talk a little bit about how this disproportionately affects those who are poor, those who are Black, and other minorities who do not have the access to health care that others have, and in particular to the immigrant and refugee communities, where this has a potentially devastating, almost genocidal effect.
Yeah, I think that their lack of access to medical care in general and the quality of care that they receive impacts them disproportionately. There's more diabetes, more hypertension. There's many more stressors that cause this population to have shorter lives and shorter healthy lives. I think that because of the difficulties in obtaining housing, they live in cramped quarters with many, many to a room. And this is just a recipe for a quick spread. I just spoke with one of my colleagues at Elmhurst Hospital, which is in Queens, and he was telling me about the numbers of Rikers Island patients that he's had that are positive. And talk about a death sentence. I mean, you know, these folks, half of whom shouldn't have been in there in the first place, but they're there, and they're now going to, there's no way for them not to get the virus because it's going to spread through these populations like crazy. Same thing down in Louisiana. I was just reading a piece by the Southern Poverty Law Center where they were looking at the numbers of who was getting infected at these centers, and they're going to have to figure out ways to let the gates open. They have to let these people out. And then there are the folks who are not sentenced to anything. They're just immigrants looking to workers in the country that have been devastated by the workings of this country. And when now they're being held in detention centers where they can't even get vaccines, even if there were a COVID-19 vaccine, they aren't allowing us to even vaccinate children down there that are in these centers. And these children have been torn from their parents' hands and arms. So this is real. This is, we're going to see deaths, and we have to take that position. Humanity comes first. American lives are not more important than any other human being's lives on this planet, and that we should be doing our utmost to mitigate this spread of this virus and open up these gates and let these people out that don't need to be there. This is just criminal and cruel, not to speak of closing the border and what's across the border with the huge shanty towns that are built up for people trying to just eke out an existence while waiting for their turn to get heard for asylum in this country. Does anybody in their right mind really think that if it breaks out there in large waves, it's not going to go across that little border? You know, of course it is. And therefore, why not? Why are you not trying to do preventive work where it needs to be done? Let them in, situate them far apart from each other, et cetera, so that we don't end up having disaster or, on top of the disaster. So yes, it's going to hit the poor, it's going to hit the minority population, and it's going to hit the Native American population really hard too.
Well, look, I'm going to pretty much wrap this up on that. It was a very that was a very important statement, the stand that you're taking. So I want to thank you for being on this show and for inaugurating the show and for the work you're doing. And you said that and told our audience that you have tested positive for this, and I just want to say, just really, I know you're going to care for your patients, but also take care of yourself. And I understand the risks of this viral overload that could come to people like yourself who are on the front lines, and that we're with you in this. But do take care, because we need people who have the scientific knowledge you have, but combine that with scientific knowledge not only of medicine, but of the societal impact of it and how these two things interrelate. So I want to really appreciate your being on this show, and just get well soon.
Yeah, thank you very much. Pleasure to be on the show, and thanks for inviting me.
Okay, take care now. Good night.
Okay, that was Dr. Phil Rice speaking with Andy Z about the very dangerous realities of this pandemic. Now I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.